from the intersection of technology and public accounting.
It's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
Hello, Greg LaFollette, recording Tech2Go Episode 7. And today is Thursday, July 26th. We're recording the August 2007 episode, and I'm welcoming all of the original panel. So we have Dave McClure on the East Coast. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello there.
Nice to hear you. Hopefully we've solved all of our audio problems and connectivity problems from last time, or I guess 2 times ago.
Certainly. Okay. Well, you know what they say, technology often, most often fails technologists, so
exactly.
Hopefully we have it fixed.
Exactly. Representing the West Coast contingent, our friend Brent Goodfellow from sunny sometimes Portland. Is that true today, Brent?
Yeah, it's absolutely sunny today, and it's still good morning on the West Coast. So.
Good for you. And my compatriot, a couple of states south, Randy Johnson, you and I are still holding down Central Time, right?
We are indeed doing that with our rain-soaked middle of the U.S.
Yeah, well, that's good for you because we're 35 days into a drought, and although it is a Chamber of Commerce day out there, it's getting pretty dry. So listen, we've got a whole bunch of things to go through today, lots of different exciting things going on. A couple of notes for everybody. Remember that as we go through and talk about things, you don't have to scramble to write down websites or product names because Vance Lucas, our producer, will go behind the scenes when we're done and wrap up all those things. And if you'll follow the show notes, just go to the website, CPA Tech Advisor, or CPATA is the cheap and easy way, .com, and follow to Intersection Live. You'll see all the show notes. So all of the goodies that my panelists talk about will all be hyperlinked there. It's a real quick and easy way to do it. Additionally, if you have any comments, questions, or thoughts that you'd like to share with us, remember our Tech2Go line is 800-456-0864, extension 2106. So extension 2106, number is 800-456-0864. Dial us up, leave us a note. We'll be happy to play it on the air, perhaps, or at least answer it. So that's where we go now, panelists. We've got lots of things to talk about. A couple of things that we're not going to talk about, though. We will be the only podcast recorded in the month of July that does not talk about the iPhone and does not talk about Harry Potter. You think we can be successful in avoiding both of those things?
This is Dave, Greg. I'm not sure what else we have to talk about then.
We're certainly not going to talk about Lindsay Lohan. So we'll have to talk about some things.
Well, Greg, Greg, this is Brent. I noted on your item on the NetSuite IPO. NetSuite on their website is now suggesting that you can run your business off of your iPhone. So maybe it's going to get in there one way or another.
I saw that, and we are going to talk about the NetSuite IPO, and I did see that they've got iNetSuite on the iPhone, and I don't care, and I heard somebody the other day say they were irate about that whole thing.
Well, and then the Today Show announced this morning under the heading of iProblem, that Apple has not reached their goal for the sales of the iPhone. It's about half what they expected.
Exactly. Well, last month I told everybody that we had a sponsor, and I want to again thank the guys over at ADP for sponsoring Tech2Go. You know, this is a real I think a a foresighted decision on their part to look out and realize that although we're a relatively small group of listeners, it's fun to watch it. I did see a hockey stick graph. I was down at in Shawnee in our offices last week, and I saw a graph that that one of our guys had prepared that showed the average number of listeners per day. In other words, just listeners, people who had listened to a podcast divided by the number of days that that podcast had been up and available to listen to. So it showed the average number of listens per day back from episode 1 through episode 7, and it's really exciting to see that hockey stick, that the line just keeps going straight up, and it's really fun. Lots of people, you know, kind of adding to the group. It was certainly fun. Randy and I were standing together at Tech a month ago, and a couple of people came up unsolicited and started talking to us about how much they enjoyed Tech or Tech to Go.
And I got to tell the listeners, Greg, that you just beamed like a rock star. I think the only thing that could have been better is if they'd have asked for your shirt. Had you signed an autograph, that type of thing.
It was pretty cool, and I know the only reason they came up and said anything is because the talent was there in you.
Yep.
But anyway, a big thanks to ADP for them doing that. And you know, it reminds there's another interesting story. I want to share something that happened to me out of Tech. I was sitting. You know, I actually got a chance where I could sit down for a minute, and I sat down and I was checking my email. I had my True out and I was checking my email, sitting in the hallway there. And an old friend came by, a practitioner that I've known for years, and I stood up and shook hands with him, and we stood there and talked for just a few minutes, just about different things, you know, what his impressions were of Tech and that sort of thing. And as we were standing there, one of the guys from ADP came walking by, Tom McNelia came walking by, and he stopped and said hi. And, of course, now I have two people standing there, so I introduced them to each other. And I said, Tom, this is, I'm going to just say Mr. X, because I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to go that far as to nail this poor guy. But I said, you know, Tom, this is Mr. X, and Mr. X, this is Tom McNelia, and Tom's with ADP, and, you know, Mr. X here is a practitioner, and as a matter of fact, Mr. X, you've got a fairly responsible payroll business, if I recall. And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, have you ever looked at ADP's stuff? And you could see his eyes kind of go, yeah. And I went, you know, I mean, ADP's got, I mean, it's more, it's not just the referral business like it was in the olden days. And so these two, about that time my phone rang, and I said, listen, guys, I got to take this. Nice talking to both of you. And they walked down the hall towards the conference center. I took my phone call, forgot all about it. And the next day, Mr. X, that practitioner, came up to me and shook my hand, grabbed my hand, and said, thank you for that introduction. We walked back over to that ADP booth, and they were over there with Microsoft. He said, we walked over there, and he showed me some things. I had no clue that they did that wholesale program. This is really cool stuff. I'm really impressed, and I think those guys, I'm not sure, but I think those guys are actually going to do some business. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and I see that every once in a while that there are many practitioners that just don't understand all of the different products and things that the ADP guys have. So anyway, it was an interesting story.
Yeah, in fact, Greg, just as collateral on that, I was commuting home from a CPA firm visit in Boston yesterday, and the associate that went with me, the consultant with me, asked me about the payroll business conversation that we'd had at the client site, because they were a fairly large outsourced provider for a good number of businesses. And honestly, when I started naming through the options and what the capabilities were, I got one of those blank stares, and they realized they had to go visit a number of these providers because the capabilities were so different. And that actually goes with an article that I completed a couple of weeks ago on the new offerings in the payroll business from so many of the providers, even traditionals like an ADP.
Exactly. Lots of exciting things going on there. We should probably put this whole payroll issue on the list to talk about sometime, because some of the products that are, and actually services that are out there, and the way that different people are slicing this is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So first topic of the day is engagement software versus trial balance software. A couple not very long ago, 4 or 5 years ago, as a matter of fact, a young man by the name of Dave Weil wrote a product called ePace, and the rest has been history. He developed that product, kind of got it going, sold it to CCH, Wolters Kluwer. They rebranded it ProFX Engagement, and that product has kind of defined the what I would call the engagement business genre. Caseware has been out there for a long, long time, but not with the same fervor, I think, for in terms of at least marketing and potential sales as CCH created. And then about a year, 18 months after that, Thompson dropped their product into the foray, and their product is Engagement CS. And so now we actually have three products out there, and all of them what I would call full-scale engagement software, kind of containerized things, and a whole bunch of accounting firms out there trying to figure out what they are doing, what they should do, where to go, what to do. I find a lot of people, unfortunately, still using ATB or using the Trial Balance Insight QuickBooks, things like that. What are you seeing, Randy?
Well, you know, Greg, it's been a fun year so far because I've been in so many CPA firms, and because of the 1215 audit regulation changes, we've got a lot of audit teams that are concerned about compliance and how that's going to work. So this has actually been a pretty darn high-profile topic throughout the year. I think you've set up the basic market correctly. The shop I was in yesterday was a CCH engagement shop. The shop just before was a caseware shop, so I've been on both sides of those particular fences in the last 2 weeks. And basically, I think you've summarized it correctly. You've got the three major competitors with...
And do you know how they stack up, Randy, in terms of user bases?
You know, I don't have accurate enough numbers, Greg, that I can say this is for sure, but I can make some guesses as to where things are going. So between us, we might get pretty close.
Yeah, you go ahead and guess, and I'll tell you, I think I've got fairly reasonable numbers.
If you've got fairly reasonable, we might go down that path. But I can tell you that caseware, typically considered the more procedural, let's call it higher-end product, if you will, certainly a long-term player, has always had relatively small U.S. market share. Somewhere 3-5% is in the zone. In Canada, of course, and I've taught seminars in Canada in the last 4 weeks, there it's 90%+ market
exactly.
Share,
and
very
and worldwide.
Dominant.
Worldwide.
And worldwide.
Very strong.
Absolutely. So that particular product, though, will become of more note because many CPA firms this year are going to be faced with the decision, what do we do if we were a McGladrey audit tool user, since McGladrey has now chosen caseware as their replacement product, and the training and rollout starting in that area. So kind of the high-end procedural product, more or less, might be considered to be caseware. In terms of CCH engagement, probably the dominant player, hard to say on exact shares, but typically in larger firms.
Yep, that would be true.
More likely 50-60% share in larger firms.
Uh-huh.
And, that product's progressed pretty nicely. I think it's rolling over from version 4.7 to 4.9 right now. Quite a number of new features in this generation of the product. The product having more, I'll call it stability and other things working better with the Microsoft products. It turns out many of the problems inside these products are caused by Microsoft operating systems and Microsoft Office issues, but it looks like a problem in caseware, engagement CS, or CCH engagement. But both caseware and CCH engagement have default template sets that really are helping. In the case of CCH Engagement, let's use their words, you know, a default binder that really can help with the appropriate advisement, and then you can roll binder information forward. We recommend normally doing data rolled forward. And then finally, Engagement CS, I think used by traditionally more small firms. I think the number of firms here is probably larger, although the total number of users might be less.
Correct on both counts.
Probably better integration in terms of working from write-up and working from other sources just because of the way that the Thompson products have been built.
Right.
So
all homegrown as opposed to acquired and bolted together.
That's exactly right. So, you know, those are the three major competitors. And, of course, the motivation for change includes the discontinuance of GoAudit, the discontinuance of the McGladrey product. And then, of course, the other thing that is used by a lot of firms, and I really frequently recommend against this, is where everything for compilation audit review is just done with PPCE tools. And that's the only thing that's being used, so there's no real engagement manager. And I think that's generally unwise if you have 15 or more of these types of engagements within your practice. The engagement managers take a little bit to learn to use, but they give you so much more control, so much more efficiency, so much more consistency that I think they're worth the training and investment in learning. Further, two key comments that I've seen consistently, regardless of whose product has been deployed. First, paperless support inside these systems is almost always done wrong by CPA firms. Not wrong by the publishers, but for example, documents are being scanned and not compressed properly, dropped into the engagement binders, greatly inflating their sizes beyond what they should be.
Sure.
That's one key issue that's repetitive. And then the second one is the key feature of linking the data either from outside accounting software products like a QuickBooks or MES-90, pulling that into the engagement manager and then uploading the data into the tax product that's being used. Those link features are often not used, with, I think, the misinformation saying, oh, it's just faster to key the data.
Right.
And again, I think that's largely unwise, and the magic number I use there is if you have more than five tax returns, let's say you're going to do, it's worth the investment to get that part right. So all three of these managers can really help productivity. And then the last piece of advice I normally give in this area is the first year that you start using an engagement manager, regardless of the publisher, you're going to have anywhere from a 5% gain to a 5% loss in productivity, and that's the learning curve. But in the second year, it's quite normal to see a 10 or 15% gain. Typically, that flows through as realization in the product, and then it's not unusual to see another 10 or 15 in the third year. So actually what you wind up with is 25 to 35% productivity gains by using the tools. The firm that I was in yesterday is in their fourth year on CCH engagement. We looked at and talked about the numbers, and in fact, they have done a little better than that. They're in excess of 35% gain over their now 3 year headed into their fourth year period.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's,
it was pretty
impressive.
It was. So in any case, those are the three key players, and if you want to count the PPC approach, kind of the do-it-yourself approach is the fourth.
Sure.
You know, here in our U.S. market, that's probably your best option. Now, one thing I would comment on is I have seen a lot more caseware this year than I had in other prior years, but by the same token, I'm also seeing broader adoption of both Engagement CS and CCH Engagement because I think firms are starting to see the value in using an engagement manager.
Right, and some of these older products are going away. And, you know, you mentioned one thing, Randy, that you mentioned the GoAudit product, and I actually blame the GoAudit product for setting back the adoption of this by about 10 years. Seems like, you know, when that product was first written by a little company up in Canandaigua, New York, and it was originally named ACE,
yep,
the Automated Client Engagement. And ACE wandered around in the woods for a few years, never really got any adoption, and it was sold, and I don't know if you remember who it was sold to, it was sold to McGladrey.
Yep.
And McGladrey had it for a few years, and then McGladrey decided that they were an accounting firm, not a software company, so they sold it, and remember who they sold it to? They sold it to RIA. And when RIA got a hold of it, they decided that they were going to rename it Go Audit, because they had they were doing that branding. Then they had Go Tax and Go Audit and Go Practice and that sort of thing. They named it Go Audit, and thousands of firms around the country at that time were also abandoning the attest function, and they looked at the product name and they said, I don't do audits, I don't need it. And so there were all of these, because we're now at somewhere between 75 and 80% of the practices in America that don't do any attest function. So they look at this oftentimes and say, I don't do audits, I don't need this. And that's even been a problem on the engagement side. People say, well, I don't do that kind of work. And I look at them and say, well, you, how much work do you do in which you have a trial balance and a couple of work papers that you have to link either to a tax return or a financial statement? Oh, well, that we do all the time. Well, that's an engagement, right?
It certainly is. And, in fact, what I've been working with in my own client base and when people ask about it is to try to get them to think about using an engagement manager, not just in the audit area of the business, but in the tax area of the business, particularly for, you know, corporate tax processing. And the idea here is to use the engagement manager to accumulate all the documentation, summarize, do the trial balance, and do all the linking. And we've actually got some firms that are on the verge of having 100% of business tax flowing through an engagement manager first, because they've figured out this truly is more effective. Some of the vendors have actually tried to sell engagement managers with terms like paperless audit, which, yeah, okay, but I think that actually obscures the strength of the tool, because there's a lot more in there than that.
Well, if you'll remember, CCH sold their product that way for quite a while, and they actually said to people, you don't need a paperless a document management system because you've got engagement.
That is
until they went and bought a paperless DMS product, and then they came out and said, now you do need one, and lucky for us, you know we have one that we can sell you.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, when you look at this this evolution, if you will, in the products, it's also clear that with the, 45-60-day lockdown rule that went into effect this year, you know, the products are trying to enforce some of that in the engagement management tool. But much like you might think about your tax product as being a repository for live data and your document management system being a repository for archival or, you know, long-term data, I think it's actually healthy to look at a lot of the engagement managers in that same way. So the complication of trying to be compliant with the rule, the way you handle your permanent files, the way you handle your tax files, and the way you handle the rest of, you know, attest function pieces inside the engagement manager, I think it takes a little bit of planning and forethought.
So, Brent, you're sitting inside a CPA firm, and you practice. How do you guys how would you characterize your engagement product and your DMS? They talk to each other, but they serve different purposes, obviously, right?
Yeah, they do. I don't practice in the auditing area, obviously, and that's why I find this conversation so stimulating for me personally. But I will tell you that we've done some testing with both the CCH product as well as the Thompson product, and you guys are right on in terms of the firms that they're designed to serve. And I think a lot of firms are moving over. As far as how it relates to DMS, our DMS product, as you know, Greg, is a product called Document Locator,
right,
which is kind of a local company. But they just went to version 5, and they've done some really interesting things with workflow, and we're very pleased with that part of it, even though it doesn't tie directly into one of the accounting industry engagement products.
Okay.
Now, one other thing I might throw in here, Greg, before we perhaps segue into another topic, and that's the whole issue of advisement. You know, the PPC company with their eTools product has had, you know, good, well-accepted advisement for a long time, and other publishers are getting much more into that act. And, you know, with CCH's acquiring Miller and some of those type of things, plus the way that the advisement is incorporated into the engagement managers, the way that it's refreshed, for example, in the caseware product, the way the knowledge base refreshment takes place, you can actually have a regulatory change or a firm position change and actually have that advisement updated dynamically. And the days of using Word and Excel documents as those checklists, I think, are beginning to come to a close with much more of a shift towards text-based, knowledge-based advisement inside these products. So, you know, the friendly piece of advice I've been given to our friends that live in the audit world is I think we're going to see more changes in audit in the next 4 years than we've seen in the last 10 or last 20. And it's a whole new world, and an engagement manager will help your teams stay in compliance in ways that you cannot with your manual processes.
I absolutely agree. It's going to be, it's going to change, and the change will continue to happen faster. Let's do that. Let's follow that segue. That we probably won't have a segue at all. We'll just probably change topics. Let's talk a little bit about Exchange 07. That's out. People are looking at it. They're going, do I implement this? If so, when? How? Brent, you're right down the road from those guys. I assume you've looked at this thing. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, we not only have we looked at it, we've implemented it in house. It's in production, so we've already gone through a couple of migrations, if you will, and I think I can probably highlight some of the main points here, and then you can just tell me if we're on the right track. Probably the most stunning difference between Exchange 2003 and 2007 is we went from kind of a single server role, if you will, to five server roles. So they've divided the roles up. Not that they weren't there in Exchange 2003, but they've divided them up as separate, distinct server roles so that administrators can actually deploy Exchange if they want to on five different servers, each server kind of serving a part of the functionality of Exchange.
And that would be for balance purposes, Brent? Or?
Well, it can be for balance, but let's go through the server roles quickly. There's what's called the Edge Transport Server, Hub Transport, Mailbox Server, Client Access, and Unified Messaging. Now, with Exchange 2003, there was no Unified Messaging, so that's something new with Exchange 2007. But Client Access, for example, in Exchange 2003, that provided the Outlook Web Access functionality. It provided the mobile device access functionality. And so that can be moved to a separate server by administrators if they want to do that. So it's a division of services, if you will. Let's talk about gotchas first, and then I'll kind of finish up with what I, in my experience, what I really like about Exchange 2007. The first gotcha that we realized early on and that most folks do is that Exchange 2007 requires 64-bit hardware.
Ah.
Consequently, it also requires 64-bit versions of the operating system to go on that hardware. In addition, you know, there's some fairly significant minimum hardware requirements. Memory, for example, minimum is 2 gig, and of course you never put the minimum in a box, so you probably want more than the minimum. And there is no, obviously because of the change in the hardware and operating system requirements to 64-bit, there's no option for an in-place upgrade. So you can't just plop the Exchange 2007 CD, program CD in your Exchange 2003 server and just do an in-place upgrade. It just doesn't work and won't work.
Sure.
The other gotchas that are kind of interesting is the Exchange team that developed 2007 is actually de-emphasizing the whole use of public folders. And I know accounting firms really rely on the whole public folders idea, so that's something to think about. And
when you
the
say
client
de-emphasizing, Brent, does that mean they're not used, can't be used, shouldn't be used? What?
It means that they're going to continue to support public folders through, they say, 2016. So that's probably past the time that I'm going to hang them up.
Right.
And a lot of practitioners perhaps, but over time, the word de-emphasize means that they want that public folder information, like the shared vacation calendars and the shared contact lists and things, to move to SharePoint services or SharePoint server, as the case may be.
Okay.
The client software, of course, we've found that Exchange 2007 works best with Outlook 2007, although we still have a number of folks who are using Outlook 2003. And it is just fine. A lot of the administration work is now done in what's called the Exchange Management Shell, which is a command line type of interface. And for administrators that don't like to work in the command line environment, that's going to be something new. So that's the gotchas. And now I'm just going to run through my list of what I see are real benefits as a result of the upgrade. The first one that we noticed right off was the built-in anti-spam functionality in Exchange 2007 is absolutely amazing. It's just awesome as far as we're concerned. We gave up our third-party anti-spam product after using the built-in Exchange 2007 anti-spam functionality, and it's just done a tremendous job of just virtually eliminating spam in our organization, which is great. The second benefit that we have seen is the performance associated with mobile access and the new and improved interface associated with Outlook Web Access. There's now an Outlook Web Access Lite option, so if you're on a slow connection, you can get the critical parts of your mailbox without consuming a lot of bandwidth.
Sure.
And the Outlook Web Access, the new Outlook Web Access client supports this out of office assistant scheduling. So, you know, we've all used this out of office thing in Outlook before, and the thing that we always forget to do is when we get back in the office, we forget to turn it off.
Right.
So people are still getting out-of-office replies when we're actually back in the office. So the addition that they've made is they've actually allowed you to schedule that now so that you know you're going to be gone from the 12th through the 16th. But you can set up out-of-office, and you schedule it to automatically turn itself off.
So it expires.
It expires, that's
cool.
Right. Yep. RPC over HTTP, which we've talked about before, is now called Outlook Anywhere.
Okay.
Just really a name change there. And, of course, with the unified messaging addition, they have added what's called Outlook Voice Access. So you can now use your traditional PBX, and with the use of a gateway device, you can connect your telephone to your mailbox, if you will. And what that allows you to do is you can actually create appointments using your phone. You can have your email read to you, that kind of thing. The full index searching is really awesome. You can literally search through your entire mailbox store very, very quickly for keywords, and it's so much improved that I kind of stopped worrying about having to file emails in particular folders so that I can drill down to find those important messages. I can literally just search for them and find them very, very quickly. And administrators have the ability to actually search across multiple mailboxes in an organization. So, you know, if you happen to get hit with some legal action and you need to pull some information to support, you know, your defense, administrators can pull that out of your entire mailbox store if they need
this,
to.
This could be a two-edged sword, though, too.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
It also means that you've got a lot better tools to answer a summons.
Well, except that before, you know, they wanted the same information, it just took a lot longer to get to it.
Right, but now it makes that information more accessible.
That's right. It absolutely
sure.
does. Absolutely does. The whole journaling idea is really easy to set up in Exchange 2007, and of course there are regulatory requirements that require journaling for anybody in financial services, and we've set that up in a couple of instances, and it's just been real easy to do. The Outlook 2007 connection to the Exchange 2007 server, they use a process called auto-discover, so you don't have to walk through this lengthy setup process. Essentially, what you do is if you're on the same network as the Exchange server, Outlook goes out, it knows who you are, it knows where Exchange is, and it creates the connection really, really quickly and easily.
Well, if you've ever had to do that, you know that that's a big benefit.
That is a huge benefit, exactly. And then just in general, you know, we've seen significant improvements in performance, and I suppose that you would expect that when you move to 64-bit hardware and software. So, you know, we've have had a positive experience with 2007.
Interesting, Randy. I know you like I outsource your Exchange. Has your outsourcer moved to 07 yet?
On the outsourcer for our K2 mail, no, not yet. They have offered. We looked at it, just had not done it yet. And I would tell you that our experience here at NMGI was very similar to what you just heard described, Brent. We actually did a coexistence of the 2003 to 2007 servers and migrated them in place. We kept both units in place during the migration, and after about a week just turned off the old Exchange 2003. So I'm live on Exchange 2007 server as well. And there are a couple of utilities out there that might be helpful for the conversion process if you don't use the coexistence approach. One of those is called PowerFile, and the other one is from a vendor called Lucid 8. So I'll make sure you have those, Greg, for your information for the session. But
good.
Overall, Exchange 2007, good, and our outsourcer has offered it. We just haven't converted.
Okay. So kind of sounds like it's time to think about pulling the trigger, stepping up, and it's reasonably solid and a lot of reasons. Sometimes we get these new I guess this is kind of like an OS. We get these new systems and there's not a clear defined reason that we should go because the it just doesn't perform all that much better or. But in this case, it sounds like there's a lot of things that make sense, especially for practicing accountants to think about moving forward.
Yeah,
and we actually might want to interject here that for those smaller firms that use Small Business Server, the Small Business Server version that's going to include Exchange 2007 and Windows Server 2008 will be out sometime next year, mid to late next year.
Okay.
But, Greg, this is Dave. Let me just, because, you know, I've been a big fan of Exchange for many, many years now.
Right.
But this is not for the faint of heart. I mean, this is going to have a learning curve that's steeper than a cardiac stress test. It's just, you're looking at a very complicated piece of software. And I want to point out, before smaller firms run out to say, wow, look at the great capabilities you get here, there's a reason why you may want to break it up across five servers, and a reminder that you got to have somebody to maintain those five servers if you do so. The 64-bit architecture should give you a little bit of pause if you're a small accounting firm
remember, I did a whole series last year on moving to 64-bit and moving right back out of it. The 64-bit architecture is for servers, not for desktops. So if you don't have a pretty strong IT function in-house, you ought to look to outsource, not build the in-house capabilities. I think you as wonderful it is, as it is, and I agree, it's marvelous. Boy, it's just not for small firms. This is enterprise strength software, and if you don't have those capabilities, outsource.
Yeah, and exactly. I think the point here is actually quite well taken, because it looks like to me, from the outcome of the Worldwide Partner Conference in Denver here early in July, that Microsoft is now stratifying towards three levels of product. Brent's dead on. The small business server mid-year next year, the new high-end Windows Server and SQL Server 2008 right now is scheduled for the end of February, and then Microsoft intends to introduce an intermediate level of software, is the basic strategic statements. So I think we're going to have these high-end enterprise, that's what we're looking at right now, and I think there'll be some new medium-grade stuff that might be more simplistic.
Right. Yeah, and I think we also have to point out that although there are these five server roles for Exchange 2007, you can actually run Exchange 2007 on a single box, and you really only need two of the five roles mandatory to do this. And obviously, if they're going to do it in a small business server type of arrangement, that may be the middleware or the medium typeware that Randy was talking about.
Right. When I look at this, and as I was listening to Dave talk about the complexities here, all I could think of is I just have one thing to say: $1,250 a month for fully implemented Exchange outsourced hosting, no limit to mailbox size, including spam, lots of places to get it for $1,250, $15, very, very reasonable, and for a small firm, there's just no reason to move to owning those boxes and trying to get, you know, trying to maintain that yourself. Now, you know, once you get to, and Brent, I think you did an article about this. Once you get to 10, 12, 14 people, the lines start to cross in terms of overall cost, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but until you get there, I mean, if you're a three-person firm, to me, this is a no-brainer.
Right.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about our friend Mr. Eliason, who's evidently trying to pull some money out of NetSuite. First part of July, they filed, they being NetSuite, filed their S-1. Saying they were going to do an IPO in about September. And, you know, I took a look at this thing, and the reason I'm interested in it, not because I'm trying to pick stocks or get involved in the IPO or anything, but simply because it's interesting to me that the SaaS, the software as a service world, is starting to kind of get very real. So when I looked at this S-1 and went, well, they're out there trying. First of all, I was amazed to find that Eliason's owns 74% of that business, which is much, much higher than what I thought. I mean, I certainly hadn't analyzed it. It was just very high. This is a business that did $67 million last year. Now, I mean, that was 85% up year over year. In first quarter of this year, they're up, I think, 72% quarter over quarter. So they're certainly growing, and things are looking up for the software as a service market overall. The whole world is growing. But you know, they've decided to go out, and they're gonna try and pull $75 million out of a business that did $67 million last year, which is fairly rich. But they're gonna do it. Interestingly enough, they're gonna do it Google style. They went and hired Hambrecht, which is the same group that did that Google auction thing, And I suppose you guys are smarter than me. You probably bought Google right at auction, right?
Not really.
or maybe not. I was way too clever to do that. So I didn't do that then. Don't know that I would now. But I thought, you know, I thought that was kind of interesting. And then I sat down, starting reading through this S1, which is really just the disclosure thing, and I found a couple of things in there that I didn't know. And one of them was that NetSuite uses a phased release process. So my assumption was that because it was software as a service, everybody got updated software. You know, it's kind of one of the beauties that, you know, we turn the software on and everybody's got it. But they've been using a phased release process, which probably is smart in that only a few of their whatever the number of customers they've got, 5,000 or something, only a few of them get to see the new stuff until they're sure that it's going to work, and then they roll it out. So that didn't occur to me that they were doing that. But the interesting thing, the one that blew me away, and I'm going to read this to you so that you're sure that you hear exactly what it says. In their statement, it says, "We host our services and serve all of our customers from a single third-party data center facility located in California. We do not control the operation of this facility." And then it goes on a little later to say, "We do not currently operate or maintain a backup data center for any of our services or for any of our customers' data, which increases our vulnerability to interruptions or delays in our service." Well, interrupts our vulnerability. How about all those? Can you think of a single business customer that would run out there and sign up if they knew that there was no backup and they were in one data center with no failover, no redundancy? Are you guys as shocked as I am by that?
Actually, unfortunately, I already knew it, and
oh.
But I was shocked. And the data center is located where, Greg?
In California. right. It doesn't say where it is in relative to the San Andreas Fault.
I've been there. It's pretty bloody close.
Well, the whole state pretty much sits on a fault. I mean, you know, so no backup is, yeah, that's huge. No question about it.
Yeah, yeah, and no redundancy.
No wonder he wants to. No wonder he wants to sell out.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably needs the money. I don't know. The other thing I thought was interesting. They list their competitors, and you know they got Epicor and Intuit. They named Intuit smart. Microsoft, SAP, Sage, and then they list Salesforce. Well, I mean so who's missing from that group? Well, they listed SAP, but they didn't list Oracle.
Right.
Well, I mean,
did they list Microsoft?
Yeah, they list Microsoft.
Oh, okay.
Intuit, Microsoft, SAP, Sage, Salesforce, and Epicor. They just forgot about Oracle. Maybe they're not a competitor. Anyway, it's kind of interesting that we see finally. This is really probably the first. SaaS company that's been out there for a while, that's well known and kind of been around, and now it's growing up and going public. Thoughts, anybody on the whole SaaS or NetSuite in general?
Well, SaaS is something that's going to continue to grow over time. I mean, look at the Softricity acquisition. You know, the whole idea of applications without the infrastructure, that's certainly hot. But I can't imagine doing that without any kind of redundancy on the servers that are providing access to the applications.
Pretty scary. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be a bidder on that on that particular auction, or whether or not it'll even pull off. It'll be interesting to tell. So let's go back and talk a little bit just about plain good old raw technology. I went out recently and I studied up, and I decided I was tired of paying $10 a pop for Never Lost when I traveled. And I don't need a nav system in my car because I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, so that's not hard. But when I travel, and you know, and I'm driving wherever I happen to be, and you know, in Philadelphia or Phoenix or wherever, trying to find things, it's kind of nice. So I studied up and I went out and bought a nav system. I bought the Nuvi 650, and I am absolutely thrilled, amazed with this little thing that's not much bigger than a deck of cards and is the smartest piece of technology I think I've bought in a long time. Runs just, you know, runs like a rock. It, you know, it sits over in a corner and just does exactly what it's supposed to do. Dave, you use nav systems. What do you think of these?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of navigation systems and have been for some time. And I don't know how any accounting professional lives without one today. Even, you know, as you know, I live in a rural area, perhaps not as rural as yours, Greg, but a rural area nonetheless. And I still use it all the time locally. It's darn good technology is what it is.
Well, not only locally, but as small as it is, you know, you throw it in your overnight bag. And like Greg said, when you get a rental car, you can kiss the charge for Never Lost goodbye, you know. So that's the real benefit that I see in these things.
Not only do I kiss it goodbye, but my system is better than Never Lost.
Right.
As I looked up and down the list, and I looked at the Magellan products, and I looked at the Garmins, and I looked at the TomToms, and there's lots of good products out there. I ended up in the Garmin world, and I ended up moving up and down the line until I finally drew the line at the 650, which is around a $500 bill street price plus or minus. And the thing that drew me to it was it's one level below. It does not have Bluetooth. But I looked at it and said, you know, I'm not going to make phone calls through this thing. So I didn't really care. I decided to step down from that. But what I really did want to see was the system that allowed the voice to pronounce the street names and whatever it is I had as a favorite. And so last week I before I left to fly down to Oklahoma to visit my office, I keyed in as a favorite the address for the offices of the CPA Technology Advisor in beautiful downtown Shawnee. And you don't need a nav system in Shawnee, but I had it anyway. And when I got to the Oklahoma City Airport and got my car, I pushed the button and it directed me right on to the interstates and around the curve, you know, the different places, and did a great job of directing me there. And I'm driving down the street approaching my spot that I had keyed in as a favorite, and I had named the favorite the CPA Technology Advisor, and it said at the next corner, turn left on Bell and arrive at the CPA Technology Advisor, and it pronounces the words. And I just kind of looked at it and went, well, isn't that nice?
It really is awesome technology, no question about it. I ended up with, I think it's a Garmin Nuvi 800.
Oh.
I didn't buy it. I was at CES in January and just went over to the Microsoft booth there, and they had this little quiz that you had to take. And so, you know, we listened to the presentation on MSN Live or whatever it is on the Nuvi, filled out the quiz and dropped it in the fishbowl or whatever it was, and then lo and behold, a month later, I got a call and said, "You're the winner of the Garmin Nuvi, and comes, you know.
Fantastic.
Another good reason to go to CES.
Yeah, that was in January of 07, so your 1099 will come about February of 08, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, Greg,
Randy, you're out a lot, Randy. What do you do with these things?
Well, you know what? I was just actually thinking I've used them for the better part of 10 years because I was a fairly early adopter on the darn things. Currently, I've got a small TomTom, and that's been, you know, a very mobile, very useful thing. I think the last time it was a real significant difference for me was in the D.C. area because I was going to see a client and traffic was bad, so I just turned off the main routed path, and it took me the rest of the way in the way it should have. I've used versions that have been Pocket PC Bluetooth integration. Those have worked okay, but not as good as these small handhelds. And actually have used the Microsoft Streets and Trips Bluetooth GPS version, which is about a $129 product, and it's actually been okay too. But it's not like using the handhelds as you're talking about.
It's much, much slower, and it just plain it's just not built as well. You wouldn't expect so. It costs a fourth as much, and it's interesting technology. I find that fun to use on an airplane every once in a while. I'll take that little GPS finder out and stick it up on the window there, and always pull the slide down, the shade down, so the flight attendant doesn't see it. They tend to not understand what it is and get a little freaky sometimes. But then you sit and watch exactly where you are. It gives you your speed and your altitude, and you know it's very interesting.
Yeah, it turns out I probably own three or four of the co-pilots, though, because
okay.
I've used the co-pilots with, Trios, and I've used it with several other devices. So they've got a model for the Motorola Q and the Pocket PCs and laptops and smartphones and so forth. So, again, the dedicated units today are pretty phenomenal. And as you said, there's some very inexpensive ones that are still quite good and even more high-end ones than you used. Not to mention for those people that are hikers, you know, the off-road versions, which
yes.
I think are pretty helpful too.
Yep, and there's a whole subculture out there of people that go geocaching and stuff. Dave, you live out in the woods. You do that?
No, I don't do a lot of that. And in fact, that's really kind of a specialized area. I was going to mention earlier that there are about three classes of navigation units. There are the handhelds or the personal navigation systems. There are the standalone travelers like the Garmins. And like you, I'm a big fan of the Garmin. And then there are the built-ins that are popping up on more and more new automobiles. And just wanted to note a couple of comments that I had about the three different classes, because I like the standalone units. The personal units are okay, but I don't find them as useful. They're just, if you need that much help getting down a few streets in town, you probably need more help than a personal unit needs to give you, unless you're out camping in the woods. And the built-in, the in-dash units in cars, you have to be very careful of. First of all, they're very pricey, and they're often multitaskers, which means they're built in as a navigation / satellite radio / DVD player. And like most multitasking systems, if one thing goes wrong, it all goes wrong. So best value for the buck, I think, are the standalone units. Small enough you can pack them in a car and take them with you when you're traveling in a rental car as well. I like them a lot. The other thing I'd mention is I'm really a big fan of units that allow you to use more than one kind of software. If they're using proprietary software, you can bet they're going to gouge you on the price. My favorite old Garmin unit would let me use Microsoft Streets. It would let me use Street Atlas. It would let me use Garmin software. Much, much more flexible for preferences.
Interesting. I'll point out to you, Dave, last night I was watching, I have my TiVo set to download some video podcasts from CNET, and one of the video podcasts happened to be about nav systems, and they showed a prototype product that I looked at and said, well, this is something I want. It was an in-dash system that had happened to have a Nuvi 800 in it, and the little Nuvi sat in the in-dash system, kind of locked in there like those removable radio face things, and when you wanted to leave, you could just pop it out and take it with you. So, you know, you were buying just kind of a docking system for it. Which I thought was kind of an interesting way. Maybe even at some point in the future, we get those things standardized enough where you could have just a docking system in automobiles where you could take your own nav system and just drop it in and away you'd go.
Sounds like a good deal to me.
Sounds fun. Let's wrap up here. I want to talk a little bit about some of the conferences coming up. We've got the Illinois show, which I now think is probably the best state society sponsored show in the country now, and that's August 21 and 22 in Chicago, and I'm speaking at that. Randy, are you going to be out there? Or?
No, I've spoken there for 3 years in a row, but I'm going to be in the beautiful country of Ireland at that point
well,
in time.
Oh, good for you. What a trade.
thanks, no.
Okay. So that's a good conference. And following that, the FICPA conference down in Fort Lauderdale. Remember, the guys in Florida have, the people down there have two conferences, one in Orlando and in May usually, and then their follow-on conference in September, the 20th and 21st. The Sleater Group has their conference, which they've grown really, really well, and I know it's going swimmingly for them this year. If you're planning to go to that, get your reservation in early because they're going to sell out. They've sold out, I think, every year for the last 5 years, and they keep making it bigger and they keep selling it out. And I think Randy, you're one of the reasons for that because you do a lot of their presentations for them, right?
Yes, I'm scheduled to do some this year.
Great. That's October 23rd to the 25th.
And by the way, your sellout advice is very important there because Doug tells me that it's getting pretty tight.
Right, right. 23rd to the 25th out in Las Vegas, so take a look at that. And they've repositioned that now, so this is not just a QuickBooks conference. It's a accounting consulting conference. So, I mean, if you're, I know the Sage people are there, the Microsoft people are there, lots of really interesting things going on there. And then the big two suite players, CCH, launched their conference. This is their third year coming up, and they're down at the Gaylord in Plano, which is a beautiful facility, and they always do just a bang up job. Boy, it's a great, really, really high class deal. Great content and a great conference, and that's the 4th through the 7th of November. And then finally, getting towards the end of these, November 8th through 11th is the Thompson, the TTA, used to be the old Creative Solutions, now TTA, Thompson Tax and Accounting Conference out in Hawaii at Kona on the Big Island. And that's November 8th through the 11th. And I'm going out to that. I was visiting with a friend of mine this morning who's also going out there, and I told him that I had a heck of a time getting a flight coming back. You know, that conference ends on the 11th, and I could not get a flight back until the 23rd. I tried and tried and tried, and the only seats were first class, and I ended up on the same flight as my wife. So
Sounds like a story to me.
It was pretty interesting. So lots of opportunities coming up. So we look forward to visiting with you. And if you see any of us out on the road, why, be sure to come up and stick your hand out, especially if there's somebody else around, and say, boy, I really love Tech2Gel. You guys are great. That makes me smile. I watched Randy. It made him smile. Again, the number for comments, 800-456-0864, extension 2106. Final thank you again to our friends at ADP for helping us pay the bandwidth bills. It's very kind of them. We appreciate it. So if you see them, tell them how cool they are, and we'd certainly appreciate that. Randy, have a great rest of the day. Thanks for your time.
Glad to. Appreciate participating with you guys.
David, nice talking to you. As always, we look forward to next month and more fun tech tips from you.
Thanks, Greg. I look forward to it as well.
Brent, thanks for the time. Now we made you probably just about miss your lunch. You're going to have to run off and have a little late lunch, right?
I could stand to miss a few lunches.
Good for you. Thanks very much. Again, this has been Tech2Go Episode 7 for August 2007. Tune in again next month. Tell your friends about us, and we'll visit again later.
That wraps up this edition of Tech2Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust.
Tech2Go has been brought to you by the CPA Technology Advisor. Visit cpatechadvisor.com for more great podcast programs from the intersection of technology and public accounting.